The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Now, after a long break, Riverdance is coming back to Ireland, and one of its creators, John McColgan, joins me now to tell us more. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Brendan.
How long since Riverdance has been in Ireland?
3 years.
Do you remember the specific point as COVID loomed? Was there a moment of realisation?
There was a moment. We had two shows on the road at the time, and there were rumours. The show in the UK had played for a month, and I was in Radio City Music Hall. And I went at the interval of the second show. I went backstage to the promoter, Jim Glancy, good Irishman. And I said, Jim, there's lots of rumours. What do you think? How are we going to do on the run here? And he said, this is your last show.
And was it because the audiences just stopped coming?
No, the audiences didn't know yet. It was because the Broadway was closing down. They closed us down. They were obviously making it up on the hoof. There was no precedent for it. So we closed it down. We had 100 people in that company that we had to accommodate going back to wherever they came from, Australia or America or Russia or wherever they came from. And the show in the UK was cancelled as well. So we had 200 people who had really lost their jobs. And not just Riverdance, but everybody in the entertainment business really suffered. But that was, we thought at the time, or I thought, oh, God, that's going to be 2 or 3 months now of this. Yeah. But, of course, we didn't think it would be 2 to 3 years.
Yeah. And they were just, they're let go. Like, they're basically gone.
That's right. They're gone. Well, we give them their livelihood, give them their airfare to go to wherever they're going. But we did keep in touch with them. And Pádraig Moyles, my main man, who's the executive producer working to me, kept communication going all the time on Zoom. We got them, we gave them projects to do. So they were engaged all of the time with the Riverdance family, as they call them, in terms of making videos, communicating with each other. And they did one 3-minute video, which was beautiful, all around the world dancing to the one piece of music. It wasn't the typical river dance, it was the slower Cuina Cuchulainn piece, and it was very moving.
And in terms of, I'm thinking of an ocean liner or something, when you shut down something like that, can you stand everything down, or do you need to keep it?
You can't stand everything down. Yeah, we have to keep it going at a certain level. We have our principals in the office. We have David R. and Kieran and Alison and Mary and Sean. So the 6 people have to be kept on, because we're constantly managing the people who are gone and then standing by as to when we can get back. And when we know we're going to get back, it's at least, we need at least 3 months to put it all back together again.
Have you lost a lot of money in the last 2 years?
Yeah.
How much?
I don't know. It could be 5 million.
That's got to hurt.
Yeah, it does. It was a very stressful period. And principally, well, not, you know, everyone has a sad story in the entertainment industry, but this was the 25th anniversary. So I was saying to myself and my team, we need to do something special with this show to make it fresh, to make it new, to reimagine, to make it, because a lot of people have seen it. And so I sat down and worked on the show with my creative people, and we came up with a brand new look with digital content on high-tech LED screens, new costumes. Bill Whelan re-recorded the soundtrack. So I wanted it to feel like a new show. I didn't want to feel like we're running it out again. So the artists, also the performers, most of them hadn't been born when Riverdance started 25 years ago. So there, I thought we would rehearse it as if we'd never done it before. So we sat down in a room in a rehearsal hall, and we talked about what the show was about, what the emotions were, what they were supposed to feel, among everything else, and allowed them to ask questions. So when it got nearer and nearer the opening in the Three Arena, everybody, including me, felt like we were opening a new show.
Yeah.
And in the reaction on the night was incredible. People had seen it a number of times and said, what have you done? It's better. It's, you know, so it worked. The reimagining worked. And at the moment, we've just finished a UK tour, which did fantastic business and were now touring in the United States. And
you had a big presence in China as well.
Yeah.
Presumably that's gone.
Yeah. We were supposed to be in China this October, and then we were supposed to be going to China next year with our other production, Heartbeat of Home. Neither of those things are happening at the moment.
There was effectively, was there a new circuit developed in China kind of around
It's an interesting story with China, and nothing is ever simple. When we went there first, it was really, really difficult. We were playing in venues. There was no health and safety. There was no proper ventilation. There was no proper heating. And my guys were saying to me, this is verging on being dangerous. So I said, guys, if that continues, you don't have to do it. You're not going back. So we had been doing so well, and this is an extraordinary story, only in China. Within 18 months, there were 10 theatres built around China called Grand Theatres. European architects built to the, like the Sydney Opera House, standard of theatre. So now we had a touring circuit that was luxury first class.
Which you probably may never go back to again.
No, we will go back. China are waiting on us, and we'll be back as soon as COVID clears up.
If we go back the 25 years, and obviously listeners won't need to be reminded that Riverdance grew from, it was a 7-minute interval act in the 1994 Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah.
And it was produced by your wife Moya and yourself. Just to get a picture, where were you at in your life and your career at that point? Were you working here in RTE?
I had finished in RTE. I had gone to work in TVIM. I ended up in TVIM as controller of programs. And then Moyen was there too. We left and set up Tyrone Productions, which is currently the longest running independent production company, and it's still running. So I was running Tyrone Productions and developing programming, as well as I had done a show with Bill Whelan in the concert hall. It was called Mayo 5000. And in that show, I had cast separately Michael Flatley and Gene Butler. And I was looking for some American performers that did something with the traditional Irish dance that invigorated or made it more entertaining. So the person that helped me find them was Paddy Maloney, because Paddy knows everything.
Yeah.
And I said, Paddy, you're around America a lot. Is there anybody there? He said, oh, yeah, there's a fella comes out now and he does a great, he's a great showman. And it's Michael Flatley and then this beautiful girl, Jean. So I cast them both. And my wife was at the concert that night in the National Concert Hall. And very shortly thereafter, she was asked to produce the Eurovision Song Contest. And her and I had been talking about possibly doing a documentary on the roots of Irish dance and how it influenced other hard shoe tapping dance around the world.
Yeah.
So she came up with the idea of that interval act. She went to Liam Miller, who was the boss.
Were you an impresario, kind of risk taker type of guy at that point?
Not at all. Not in that way. I was developing and producing television programs. And this was my first big theatrical event. And it only happened after the Eurovision. When I saw her, I was at rehearsals, and Bill Whelan was a friend, and I had done lots of TV with him. And I saw it evolve with Michael Flatley and Jean. I saw the music evolve and the choreography. Mavis Ascott, who was a famous choreographer, worked on it also. We knew in the rehearsal room that there was something special happening. Mm. Which it's magic in a bottle. You can't quantify it till you get that element of the audience in. But we held our breath, and the word had gone out in RTE. People who were at the rehearsals in the Boyne said, "You got to come in and see this. There's something special going on here." And on the night, I was in the audience. Moya was backstage because for the first year, she had pioneered doing the voters in vision around the world, around Europe. It had been only audio, and she got together with guys in technology. Guys said, can we do this in vision? So anyway, they did, and she was managing that backstage. And I was in the theatre, and I never forget, you can see it on television now, when Michael Flatley and Jean and all the young dancers, when they stamped and stomped, there was silence for 3 seconds. Mm-hmm. While people gasped and took their breath. And then without any prompting, every single person jumped to their feet, including Mary Robinson and including all the VIPs from around Europe. So it
massive was... Massive sigh of relief from you.
Massive sigh of relief. And also the knowledge that there was something special, lightning in a bottle, we had to do something. Yeah. It would evaporate if it was not activated. So within
Is Moya the manager, practical person in this, and are you the kind of
drama queen? Yeah, we work together, is, I suppose, the producer that's in terms of raising money and putting it together and all of that. And I would be the, I suppose, the central creative. I direct it, yeah. I cast it, I put it together.
But you've never done anything like this before. So
never,
Where do you start then? How do you turn it into a show? And how do you know where to bring it or what to do with it?
Well, I was very experienced on doing big variety shows on television. So it wasn't a major leap to do it again. And the first time when I put it together and when we put it together, it was televised. So my I have no fear of doing a big TV show. But it really was... a big TV show on stage. And we figured that we would have to get it right on the 2 hour long show as opposed to the 7 minutes. So we searched the world for credible ethnic dancers from wherever we could find them, but there weren't that many. But we did find a Mosyaf dance company in Russia, and they were fantastic. We found Maria Paquez from Spain, who was an amazing flamenco dancer. And we had African-American tappers. We had an African American choir in the first iteration, and so yes, we put it together. Sat down with Bill and Moya, did the running order, developed a storyline, and we were lucky that it took off from the first performance. We invited promoters from all around the world to the first performance in The Point, and it was immediately booked for Radio City, for Hammersmith, for Germany. So there was a queue of people wanting to book it. And within 3 years, we had 4 companies on the road.
And you learned that business literally as you put...
As you did on your feet, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And did RTE miss a trick? You know the way it's always kind of said that RTE should have been the ones to do the
river dance? We would have been delighted. And we offered RTE to get involved, and they said, no, we don't do stage shows, we do television. So we cooperated with them on the television. They invested in the beginning in the show, and that we were very supported by RTE, but nobody in their right mind would have thought that it was going to last as long as it did, or yeah, be as successful as, and if they knew then what they know now, of course, they might have taken a different approach. And we weren't against that. I mean, we said to them, do you want to get involved, a partnership in this going forward? And they said, no, I don't think so.
And were you conscious yourself that you were taking a big risk here? Like, did you kind of, not literally, but figuratively,
yes,
put the house on it? Like,
we did. We did.
These things can fail very expensively.
Yeah, well, I never had any doubt. I'd never seen anything like the audience reaction. I was absolutely convinced. So I wasn't apprehensive, really. But we went to a number of people to invest. We needed to raise $1 million plus to put it on in The Point, which was a big number then. And we went to a number of people. Some people did invest. And then some. Then the next thing we did, I suppose, we casted, we rehearsed it, and we went on the Late Late Show. And Gay, coming up to Christmas, Gay said, now everybody has to go out and get tickets for the Mammy and Daddy. This is going to be fantastic. And you have to see it. And I've seen the rehearsals. And this is amazing. So it sold out the next week. Its first run on
what
The Point.
What do you think it is? Like, even thinking of those audiences in China flocking to it and whatever, do you know what it is?
There's a number of things. There's no language barrier. And in China, they really respond to the percussive hard shoe. That really excites them. It seems like it's a common language. It's just that those rhythms that are primal, and that does affect people. And there's lots and lots of stories. When I went to Japan, and again, we didn't know at the end of the first number in Japan, there was a silence where there'd normally be a roar and applause. And I thought, oh, fuck, this is not going to happen. But at the end, the audience, it's just culturally different, ran down to the stage and they were throwing red roses on the stage. And then I was interviewed by a Japanese journalist. He spoke perfect English. And he said, I was so moved. He said, I was crying for a lot of the show. And I said, why were you crying? He said, looking at our country that were defeated in World War II, we have no respect for our culture. We don't develop our culture. We don't put our culture on. We're a big company. You're a small country that was dominated by another country for hundreds of years. And here you are standing proud and tall and putting on a sample of your culture in dance and music. And he said, I found that very moving.
Mm. It's amazing, really, that no one had kind of thought of that before, isn't it?
It's not something you can think of because Irish dance, I mean, it is something you can think of, but it's not obvious because Irish dance was Jury's cabaret and was wigs and curls and embroidered costumes. Moya changed the look. The girls wore black short skirts and black tops. The boys wore black shirts and black trousers. It was a real shock of a look that hadn't been done before.
So it's reframing a whole cultural thing and basically kind of changing the game around what it is.
It is. My sister is an Irish dancer and an Irish dance teacher, so I had a lot of connection and pride and respect for Irish dance, and I wanted to make sure that the history and the technique was not overshadowed by the entertainment value.
And is that what happened with Michael Flatley? Because the story goes he was fired, in quotes, just before he opened in London.
He wasn't fired, he was in contract negotiations and we couldn't bow to the demands.
Okay, now what he would say is, he says, I have the quote here, I just wanted control over the work that I had created myself. I felt like I built it and they took it and it hurt.
I know, it's a story. We all can tell whatever story began from with hindsight, and that is a story that he trots out and it's not true. He made an enormous contribution to Riverdance. I respected him enormously and he was a significant element in the success of the show. I would never take that away from him. But at one point it went to his head and we were going back for a second run in London and he thought that he had the opportunity to hold us over a barrel if he didn't do it.
Okay, well, look, that's your version of the story.
And no, it is the story.
He's told his version of the story as well, so I don't think anyone need to get in the lawyers again. But is there a sense that what you were saying there about wanting to hold on to the kind of pure drop of the thing and the culture and everything?
Yeah.
When you look at his subsequent work, did he want to take it in another kind of
flashy? No, he did. It was funny. I remember we were rehearsing and, as I say, I was getting on very well with them and we had one entrance in the show and he said, John, I have an idea. He said, I can take my top off and I can have oil all over my body. I can run on and I can slide up my knees and stop on a dime. I said, Michael, save it for Vegas.
Yeah, and fair, he did. Like, not, yeah, exactly. And like,
and he did great.
Not a bad stunt, and it worked very well for him. Yeah. I was reading that as a kid, I think when you came to Dublin first, like, one of your ideas was maybe I'd become a movie star.
That's right.
Just listening to the whole thing, this is not a criticism, but Irish people might often take it as a criticism. You don't lack for confidence, do you?
No, I do believe in myself.
Yeah.
And to some degree, I put that down to my mother. I was the eldest of nine. She would go around our beds every night and she would kiss me on the forehead. She would say, I love you, O'Grawl. You're the best boy in the whole world. And that was her mantra.
Yeah.
And whenever I left school at 14. I had jobs in factories and pubs and bars and so on. And I got into RTE Henry Street as a boy messenger, where I was subsequently fired. So there was years of trauma there. And she always said, I know you'll make it.
You've covered a lot there. Now, let's go back a little bit and break that. So, okay, we have an adoring mother, the key to confidence. So why did you leave school at 14?
I was doing Latin declensions. Dominus, Domini, Domino, and I just stand up in front of the class and do it. And every time you missed one of the detentions, you got two slaps on the hand. Now, slaps with a big black leather. And the slaps were very painful. And I was doing a John Wayne, gritting my teeth and not crying. I got 12 slaps that day. And after I got the third or fourth slap, I couldn't remember my name hardly, rather than Latin declensions. So I went back down and sit down, and I saw the next boy going, getting the same treatment. I saw him wetting the floor. And I had a bicycle that I rode to school, and it was, we were up in Clonmel Road, up near the Autobahn, Ballymun Avenue, and it was 5-6 miles, and I couldn't ride my bicycle because my fingers were so swollen, I couldn't hold the handlebars. So I walked my bicycle home, and on the walk I thought solemnly about me and about school. And again, confidence may be a word. I thought I was a great fellow. I thought I was very bright. I said, no, I'm going to be an actor. And I'm not going back there again to be beaten. I didn't deserve it. It wasn't right. It wasn't proper. So I'm not going back. So that caused huge explosion at home. My mother said, I'm not sure about that. And my father said, you have to go back. And the Christian Brothers came up to the house. And I don't know whether they thought legal or whatever. They said, no, you can do come back and we'll make sure this doesn't happen again. And you won't have to pay. And in those days, you had to pay for secondary school. There were fees. And they said, you don't have to pay, you can come back. And I'm amazed at myself looking back at it. I was quiet and calm. There was no volume for me. I just said, I'm not going back. My father said, it didn't speak to me for 2 years. And,
your mother?
My mother was supported me. She said, I always know you'll be fine, McGraw. Whatever you do, you'll be good.
And how does a 14-year-old make his way in the world then?
The first job was in a bar in Ringsend called The Yacht. I went over there.
Oh, yeah, still there.
I went over there to be a lounge boy. Then I went to Unidair, which was a factory in Finglas. Then I was always going to look for a few more Bob. Then I went to Saxo on O'Connell Street. I don't think it's still there. Shoe shop.
Yeah.
I was a delivery boy there. And then I went next door to Best's in O'Connell Street because they paid 5 shillings a week more. At some point in all those travels, I think it was in Unidair, I got a job as a telegram boy. Do you remember what telegrams are, Brandon?
I have heard of them.
Yeah, I was delivering telegrams. I had a very nice little uniform with a hat and a black leather belt. And I wasn't very long in Dublin. And I remember going into the office down at the back of the GPO. They hand you a little stack of green envelopes with the telegrams in them and you had a little pouch. And they send you out into the world. Now, I remember cycling up to O'Connell Street. And the first telegram was to be delivered in Talbot Street. I went up to a guard and I said, excuse me, guard, where's Talbot Street? So he said, it's over there. And he was laughing. And then I did that for about a year and I enjoyed it. And one of the most enjoyable things was delivering to the flats in Ringsend and the flats in Sheriff Street. The people were getting money sent home from England. And they were the warmest and most generous people. And they always gave you a tip, a shilling or whatever it was. Whereas business and other people getting telegrams wouldn't and didn't. But I do remember the Sheriff Street community. You were delighted to see Sheriff Street on your envelope because you get a tip.
Yeah. What happened in RTE then?
I remember being interviewed. Yes, there was a job for a boy messenger in RTE. Excuse me, take a drink of water.
Yeah, go on, take a drink. Because RT was in the GPO at this stage.
GPO,
was it? Yeah.
And I remember going in, there was a guy called Sean O'Murugu, he was personnel. And I applied for Boy Messenger, and he said, oh, what do you really want to do? I said, oh, I want to work in. Television was just starting that year, it hadn't gone on air yet. So this was 1960. And he said, you'll never get to work in television. And I said, why not? He said, you have no experience, you have no education. I said, but I can start in the props department. I can start anywhere, I don't mind. He said, you have no experience to start in the props department. He said, at the end of 2 years, the contract for Boy Messenger, you'll be let go. I said, okay. So then I did that job, which I enjoyed enormously. I got to meet all the actors in the rep. I got to meet Gay going in and out, Gay Byrne. I got to meet, you know, all the Seamus Ford and the Daphne Carrolls. The rep was fascinating for me because I thought I wanted to be an actor. And I spoke to a guy called, a producer called P.P. Maguire. And he knew I wanted to be an actor and he was head of drama. And he said, I will give you a part. I said, oh, no, they don't want me. And one of the phrases was, they didn't want me fraternising with play actors, which was code for don't be near them fellas in there because there's a lot of them we're not sure about.
Okay.
Who, I didn't know what that meant at the time. But
so who didn't want you near them?
The head of personnel.
Right. Because you were younger.
Because I was a pretty boy of 15 or 16 or something, and I didn't see that or recognise it. But anyway, P.P. Maguire did give me a part in a play, and I had to come in and record it on a Saturday so they wouldn't see me be recording the play. I went in, it was called Fort of Gold, and I had a little part in it, and I did it. And about a week later, a cheque for a guinea came through the office that I was in and was seen by the head of personnel. And he called me in and he said that he had warned me not to fraternise with play actors. I had disobeyed him and I was on a month's notice of being fired. So, in parallel to that, the end of the happy story, I had gone out to, or I'd applied to RT Television for a job as a vision mixer. And the day after being fired in Henry Street, I got a note from RT Television saying, "Dear Mr. McColgan, regard your application for a job as vision mixer. We're glad to tell you that you've been successful. Can you start as soon as possible?"
Okay.
So I had to go to the guy in Henry Street and say, "Excuse me, do you mind if I leave next week?" So that's how I started. My real education was in RTE Television in those glorious heady days of the 60s.
Heady days it was, where kind of anything was possible.
Anything was possible. We were working
all kinds
drama.
Of odd people ended up
with Jim Fitzgerald, Peter Collinson, Chloe Gibson, Sheila Richards, all producing and
people with various life experiences.
I'm supposed to be promoting Riverdance.
Yeah, okay. Are you still very involved? Yeah, look, we got sidetracked there, but that was interesting.
Right.
Yeah. Are you still involved day to day?
So
you're traveling around the world and all that?
Yes, I am. Not as much as I was. I have a wonderful guy called Porrick Moyles, who was a lead dancer for 18 years, and he's now titled executive producer and associate director, and he's brilliant. He's hands-on and pays all the attention to the detail. We meet two or three times a week, so I'm intimately involved with any major decisions, but he does the heavy lifting.
But you're not moving to any kind of retirement or anything?
No, not really. Semi-retired.
See, this is very gauche of me now, but I am fascinated by it. You've made a lot of money, right? And I think all of us imagine, if we made a lot of money, that we wouldn't work and we would go off and enjoy the money. Do you enjoy the money?
Yeah, I don't see it as the money. You have a lifestyle. I have children. I have a beautiful granddaughter called Lola, who's the light of my life. And I never want to not work. I couldn't imagine getting up some morning and not having anything at all to do.
Yeah.
Even though I'm semi-retired, I do take the benefit of that and I go abroad and I go to spas and I go on holidays and so on. But I love the business. I'm blessed to be in this business. And every morning I get up to go into work, to work with singers and dancers and choreographers and musicians. It's a joy.
So you feel that the life of leisure that we'd all imagine we would have if we had millions would drive you nuts, yeah?
I wouldn't even contemplate it. Even though I've been accused in the past of being a workaholic, working too hard, working too much, and maybe I was, but I'm not now. I do take it easy, but I do like to be involved in the creative industry and in this show, which is 27 years old, and I'm very proud of contributing to keeping the standard as it is, reinventing it, and giving pleasure to audiences all around the world.
And do you have another? Do you have one last?
We have a show called Heartbeat of Home, which we did a few years ago.
Yeah,
and we were due to put that on again in China, but we may put that on again. It's another good show, and there's a couple of other projects.
Are there a few things bubbling up there? Yeah,
just a little
bubble.
Go on. We are thinking about a new an adaptation of The Pirate Queen, the show we did with Claude Michel and Claude Michel Schoenberg and Alain Boubile.
Okay, which and people are going to think, is that not the one that flopped?
Your definition of flop depends where you're sitting. It was a great show. Ben Bantley in the New York Times didn't like it that much. A lot of people did. And there were things wrong with it. But all of the things that are wrong with it are fixable.
Okay. So that could be back.
Yeah.
Listen, great to talk to you. You. Being an impresario now, you'll want to give us Riverdance dates.
I will certainly will. We're starting in Cork, which is in the Marquee. We've been there before. It's an amazing venue. It's like being
it's
in
fantastic,
a circus.
Isn't it?
It's a big striped tent, and we did it there four years ago. But it's fantastic, and I love working with Peter Aiken, who is a wonderful promoter. So we're going down there, and I'm down there next week, and this is my glasses. So
you're the 3rd to the 5th of June in the
Marquee. 3rd to the 5th, we start on the 3rd, and bookings are very strong. There are some tickets left for the Sunday night. The other nights are nearly booked out.
Okay, and then the Gaiety, kind of the summer run in the Gaiety, then from the 17th of June, and that's right up to the 11th
of September. And then the summer school is a big thing I'm really proud of. Most of our new dancers come through our summer school, which has been set up in Boston and Dublin by Porrick Moyles.
Okay.
And the young dancers are trained, and then they become professionals in the show.
John McColgan, thank you very much.
Thanks for your time, Brendan.
Email brendan@rte.ie.